Hello, and thank you for coming out. This is a really great turnout. I'm excited to see that because we put quite a bit of work into this and we weren't sure anybody was going to be here. So it's always good to see there's an audience for your hard work. So my name is Patrick McCauley. I'm a house painter and home restorer and a realtor. And I've restored a few houses in town, historic houses. And that's actually where Susan and I met. So in 2006, I bought this house on Pontiac Trail. And my friend Ed Rice, who's in the front row here, was friends with Susan and introduced us. And he said, Susan, you've got to learn about this guy Pat's house. And there were a number of things that were kind of interesting about it that immediately piqued Susan's attention when I told her. So the first thing is there's a very, very steep staircase going nearly straight up like a ladder. The exposed corner posts on the interior are a holdover from colonial era building techniques. So they're only in Ann Arbor's earliest buildings. And then other little clues. I found some initials in the basement. They're very hard to read, but it's PHH April 1860 something. So this immediately piqued Susan's interest. It piqued my interest because I'm a historian. I was a history major at U of M. And maybe Susan can elaborate on that a little bit.
I walked into Patrick's house when he was having a party at his closing. And I said, oh my God, corner posts. Oh my God, this is a really old house. And I just said, this has got to be from the 1830s. But we knew the house had been moved. So we had to start. It's very hard to figure out the age of a house when it's been moved. And Patrick is an incredible researcher. And he may say he learned a lot from me, but I learned a lot from him. And he's really good with the computer. I like to tell people, when I wrote the 1992 edition of the book, there was no internet, there was no Google, and there was no email. And people say, how did you write a book? I said, you did it the old-fashioned way. You went to the library. You opened a book. You took notes. Anyway, so we started collaborating on researching this house, and we figured out where it had come from. It's on the former Lund estate, which some of you may know. The Lund house is a fabulous Greek Revival house on Pontiac Trail that's still surrounded by big lot. And it was even much bigger. And when the Lunds died, it was bought by a woman named Eliza Partridge and divided up. And Patrick's house turns out to have been the original Lund house that was moved off the property. Oh, well, it stayed on the property until it was divided into lots. And I could go on, but I won't.
Yeah, and I'll just add that. So the first thing Susan did when I started researching is she just opened up her unbelievable archive of local history to me. She has file cabinet after file cabinet full of everything on historic buildings, famous people in Ann Arbor. It's quite an amazing resource. So she started sending me maps, and that's how we realized that the house was not, it was moved at some point. The Lund family, this was their house in the 1860s, and up there circled in red is my house in 1869, and we think it actually came from right around here. And the reason we know it was connected with the Lunds, and here's Mrs. Lund, and I found a picture of her in my research. This is a picture of the other Lund house on Pontiac Trail, the more famous Lund house. The reason we were able to figure out that it was the Lund's house was the initials in the basement. I was able to connect them. I went back to the directories and looked up everyone with an H name from the 1860s. And again, old-fashioned research, so it wasn't all modern bells and whistles. There was a lot of old-school research going on. And I found a man named Philip Henry Howland. And so I did a little internet sleuthing and found that he was the brother of Mrs. Richmond. And this is Mr. Richmond, Charles H. Richmond. Charles H. Richmond is Mrs. Lund's younger brother. So I found the initials in the basement, and then I later found out that the Richmonds lived on the Lund estate and lived in my house while the other family lived in the bigger house. We were never able to pin down when it was built, so this is another interesting thing I kind of came upon in a preservation magazine is dendrochronology. So it's using tree rings in the wood in the house to determine when the house was built. And so we basically, I cut a samples of wood out of the basement, and you can see the different years here. That I sent them down to Tennessee, so you see 1790, 1800, and you're getting to 1830, 1840, and the tree was cut down in 1845, the same year the Lunds bought the property. So they built the house in 1845. So Susan and I were collaborating on this for a couple years. She has a stack of printed emails from our research, and I love the original historic buildings book. I bought it when I was in college at U of M, and I kind of kept hinting to Susan, hey, are you going to revise the book? It's a little out of date. I would love to help you. And so I kind of weaseled my way into revising the book. I think Susan can elaborate on this. It was on her plate for a while, but I don't think she necessarily wanted to undertake it on her own.
That's pretty true. I knew that the book was, if you read an entry, you could find something in it that was wrong. There was probably true of every single building in that book. That thing, it was just out of date, or we knew that dates had changed when things were built, or they were demolished and they shouldn't have been in the book anymore. We had a few poster children, which we're going to show. Yeah, there was two of them. The Anne Bray, which is on the right, which was on East University. That's now where the Zaragon is. And the Planada, which is on East Ann by the hospital. And that's now a parking structure. And they were both very well-maintained buildings inside and out, which was another reason why it was a shame to lose them. But they were also high-density housing that you don't find very much anymore. There was a spurt of activity in the 20s, and then that ended. So, I'm already off the topic, but so what else is new? I did want to revise the book, but I had played the youngster to Marjorie Reed's original book, and then I found Patrick, who was willing to help me, and he could play my former role. And so what this resulted in was, because he's a house painter, he knows every building in Ann Arbor, and he took me on drives. We went on four separate drives in a car. He was driving, I was taking notes. He would pull up to a house and say, you should know this about this house. And what do you think about this Bath Street? Now, whoever goes up over there, it's such a small street, one block long. But it had some really unusual buildings on it. And so we wound up doing that, going to Ann Arbor Hills, which I was very unfamiliar with, and learned a lot about mid-century modern, one of the proudest things we did is we have a whole chapter on mid-century modern, and we have a whole chapter on University of Michigan buildings. And there still, to this day, is no comprehensive history of the U of M buildings in print. But there is now. We did 40 buildings, and I'm happy to say that we didn't do the former homeopathic hospital because it's biting the dust. But since we wrote the book, the bus depot has bitten the dust. So, you know, things are in constant flux. You never, you think you're done, and then we almost lost the Stake Theater. Just things are always in flux. What can I say? But anyway, Patrick has done the yeoman work on this project. He did the maps for the book. He did all kinds of extra stuff.
Yeah. So as Susan was mentioning, the evolving scene of Ann Arbor. I mean, there was moved buildings. So, for instance, next door to my house on Pontiac Trail is the Bohemus House, which was moved from Washington Street. It's going to be the future home of the African American Historical Museum of Washtenaw County. Susan also mentioned mid-century modern. There are newly historic buildings that in 1992 or in the 1970s, when the first edition of historic buildings was written, they were 15 or 20 years old, maybe. And in 1992, they were 30 years old or 40 years old. So now they're well over 50, and a new generation of architectural enthusiasts is really embracing those. So we wanted to really cover something like that and bring that into the dialogue about what is worth saving in town. And So going through the list of buildings, as Susan said, we did a driving tour, and we would just find things like, oh, that's an interesting building. What's the story behind that? So we'd start looking into it and find an interesting story. But we also wanted to cover things that people don't necessarily think about, different styles, folk houses, commercial buildings or industrial buildings. We really wanted to cover a broad spectrum. And I think that the book is 460 pages, the new book, and has 375 buildings. And a lot of the technological changes have made such a daunting project possible. Searching through internet newspaper archives, that wasn't available when the first book was written, and it really made a huge difference. You found out so much more personal information about people living in 1880 than you never would have done it had you, unless you browsed through the newspapers, which nobody really do. Susan's done it. A few of us crazy researchers have done it, but searching through Google Books, searching through the newspaper archives that are now digitized, genealogy forums, it really opened up a whole new spectrum of research and information that never was available 30 years ago. So it really allowed us to write a more in-depth book and cover a lot more ground in a shorter period of time. And so this book, the new book, started in 2008. That's when we started coming up with the list and started researching. And we just released it in May of this year. So a good 6-year project. So the obvious place to start when you're thinking of Ann Arbor buildings are some of the landmark buildings of town that everyone knows about, or people have walked by a million times, great pieces of architecture. For instance, the Wilson War House, which is considered one of the finest Greek Revival houses in America. That's on Division Street. The Silas Douglas House, which was built in 1848 in the Gothic Revival style. That is the first architect-designed house in Ann Arbor. So including those types of landmarks was an obvious place to start.
What's our next slide? Another obvious landmark. This was built as the Michigan Central Railroad Station in 1886, I believe. Yeah. And I always forget. It's Spear and Rones, I believe, an architecture firm from Detroit that built other buildings in Ann Arbor in the Richardsonian Romanesque style. And all of you know this building is the Gandy Dancer. It's been the Gandy Dancer since 1968. I believe the train stopped. I was an undergraduate here. I came here in 64, and I'm from Chicago. And I would take the train home from that station, and I remembered the beautiful ceiling. It was a pretty junky building by that time. It hadn't been maintained, but the ceiling was struck me as fantastic. And so when it closed, we were all worried that it was just going to be demolished. But Chuck Muir came along and was a big fan of preservation. And I was on the Historic District Commission and when they were celebrating their 100th anniversary, and I dealt with him. And he was just a super nice guy. It was quite tragic the way he died. Okay, I could go on, but I should not the next slide. You want to do the next
one? Yeah, and again, the Gandy Dancer is a great, great example of adaptive reuse of a historic resource. So when people say these buildings have outlived their usefulness, you can point to all types of examples where people have rehabbed them, repurposed them for new uses. Another thing we tried to include were things that are not only historic, but they're landmarks today, like Zingerman's. People go to Zingerman's, it's lined up out the door every weekend, and we thought it was important that people learn about these buildings that they're interacting with on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. Another thing we were looking at was historic farmsteads that are now within the city limits. There's quite a few. The Toomey House on Washtenaw Avenue is a wonderful example of the Italian 8 style that we decided to include in the book. St. Thomas Church, there were a lot of churches that we went through trying to determine. We've actually missed a couple that probably should be in, but for the next edition, But we went through and surveyed all the churches in town and tried to cover a broad spectrum of those as well. This is the Kingsley Post Apartments, I believe. Is that right? Kingsley. Yeah, it was designed by Ralph Gerganoff in 1929, a classic example of, well, it's kind of Moorish Art Deco, a great, wonderful apartment building, especially seeing the loss of the two other ones that we showed earlier. It's great to see this one protected by a historic district and going to be here for a long time to come. Iconic building, very iconic State Theater, which hopefully is going to continue to be a movie theater in town. Do you have anything to add to that?
I was just going to mention that the architect is C. Howard Crane, who designed the Fox Theater and the Orchestra Hall in Detroit. And he was famous for his acoustics. This is one of the last buildings he built in America. I was just reading about him today. Apparently he got depressed during the Depression, and he moved to England where he died. He's buried in London. But he did something like 2,500 theaters in America, and 50 of them are in the Detroit metro area. It's phenomenal. And unfortunately, the interior was gutted for Urban Outfitters, but there are remnants of it in the lobby. When you walk in, you can see the recessed lighting and the mosaic floor. That's from the outer, I guess, foyer. So look next time you're there.
And again, another modern-day landmark that we wanted to include, the Fleetwood Diner, which was built in 1948 and 49 by the Dagwood Diner Company. It's been remodeled. It used to be covered in yellow enameled panels. But again, it's very much an Ann Arbor landmark that we wanted to include in the book and tell the story of. It was one of the first all-metal buildings in Ann Arbor. So. Like I was mentioning earlier, we did a big survey of the schools in town. Here we have the Burns Park Elementary, which was built as Tappan Intermediate School. And then we have Angel Elementary. There's a huge building boom in the 1920s of Ann Arbor. I think it went along with the population boom after World War I. You find a lot of population booms after big wars. So by the 1920s, all these vets were having kids, and the town expanded dramatically, thus the building of all these different schoolhouses around town that we included in the book. Again, the historic churches. One that we thought was kind of interesting was the Second Baptist Church here, and maybe Susan can tell a little bit about that.
If any of you drive out Beeks, you will know that this is a major presence at the corner of 4th Avenue where you... It is 4th. I get 4th and 5th mixed up all the time, even after all these years. 5th. Okay. It's when you're going into town, you drive up that street. Anyway, this is by the local architecture firm of Fry and Kazarin, who did the first national building, which was the big skyscraper at Main and Washington. And they did things in a lot of different styles. And this is, I would call, more modern. It's from the 50s. It was the Second Baptist Church originally, which is a black church, and it is now a school. And this neighborhood was in the 20s and until the 70s, really, the only neighborhood black people could live in Ann Arbor. So this was their local church. And it replaced a previous church that was on the site.
So we also wanted to cover, just again, trying to make a broad spectrum of town and what's out there and what people we think people should know about and hopefully learn about and very much appreciate someday and preserve. We included the West Park Bandshell, which is built in 1938 by the WPA, the site of many historic concerts, Grateful Dead, MC5, Ann Arbor Civic Band plays there regularly. And then while it's not technically a building, there's so many great monuments that we included. Fairview Cemetery and also Forest Hill Cemetery is included. And if you ever have a chance to go down there, you should check out the Civil War monument to the men of the Fifth Ward that died during the Civil War. It's pretty spectacular. It was built in was raised in 1874.
The north side of town where Patrick lives and where this cemetery is was a hotbed of abolitionist movement people who were very active in the anti-slavery movement. And the Beckleys, Guy Beckley was the editor of an anti-slavery newspaper that is digitized through the Ann Arbor District Library, so you can read that. And that's why there are so many veterans and fallen soldiers from this part of town, because they were very active in the anti-slavery movement and joined up when the war started.
Yeah, there were 40 men from the Fifth Ward that died during the Civil War, and that was out of 175 voters. So it was huge casualties. And again, the fervent abolitionists. And one thing that's really great, if you are ever interested in local history, go to the local history section of the Ann Arbor District Library website. It's an incredible resource. County histories, maps, the Signal of Liberty, the old news that includes the 1880 from the 1880s to the present, newspapers. A really, really, really amazing resource. And with your library card, you can access other things like Heritage Quest, and there's other newspaper archives you can access through the Ann Arbor District Library website. So if you're looking up anything, want to research anything, that's a good place to start for local history. Public buildings were kind of an important thing that wasn't really included in the old book, and part of it could be the age. Many of the main public buildings in Ann Arbor are from the 50s and 60s. They replaced earlier buildings. For instance, the Washtenaw County Courthouse was literally built around the 1870s courthouse, and then that was later demolished. And Susan's done some research on that too.
Yeah, there was a clipping file that I discovered at the Hatcher Library that had day-by-day descriptions of what was going on with the building of the new courthouse. And when it opened, they were passing papers from one window to another. That's how close the buildings were. So the parking lot behind the current courthouse is the site of the older courthouse. And I'll put in a plug for my other book, Lost Ann Arbor. That courthouse is on the cover, and I think that was quite a loss. And I hope that the building that's there now by Gurganoff, another Gurganoff building, is appreciated for being a great example of a 1950s building, because many of those features are intact inside. And I just hope that our book helps people appreciate that.
Yet another building here is the Ann Arbor District Library. Unfortunately, they voted to alter the Alden Dow original design of the blue band. It's in pretty rough shape. We were hoping they were going to do something a little more sympathetic, but they're not. But that we wanted to include as many of the buildings by famous architects as we could. Alden Dow, architect laureate of the state of Michigan. That was one of his designs for a public building in town, in addition to the City Hall, which we also included in the book. So one thing I was particularly interested in was the search for Ann Arbor's oldest house. And I know this is something Susan's done a lot of research on, too. We have four candidates. So the first one is on Ann Street here, right across from City Hall. And that's the Mills Breed Corselius House, built in about 1831. It's a very unassuming house, and I don't even know that anybody knows it's as old as it is. But it's actually, it's been covered in aluminum siding, which definitely doesn't help. But it old pictures show it that it had federal-style details in the gables, which were altered at some point. And so it's a very early building, built in 1831. Another one is the Wilcox and Easton House at 511 East Ann. This is, people always ask, what's your favorite building in Ann Arbor? This is my favorite building in Ann Arbor, and it's unfortunately falling into ruin. But it's a great example of what the early buildings in Ann Arbor looked like. It's a very New England style I house with some Greek Revival details. The windows are not symmetrical, really. They're a little off kilter. We think it might date to as early as 1827. We don't know because it was moved from its original location. And we think it came from the corner of Division and Ann Street, just about a half a block away from where it stands now. And it was built by Washtenaw County's first prosecuting attorney, Gideon Wilcoxon, in around 1827. So those are two of our candidates for the oldest building. Another one here is on Pontiac Trail. It's the Anson Brown House. Anson Brown was the founder of Lowertown, Ann Arbor, where I live. He developed all the land along Broadway and Pontiac Trail, and he built this house. We're not exactly sure what year he bought the land, in 1829. So the house was built sometime around 1830 or 1831, 1832, something like that. But so with that said, the oldest building that we know of in Ann Arbor is the dining room portion of Cobblestone Farm. I don't know, I'm sure most of you have been to Cobblestone Farm if you've lived in Ann Arbor long enough. So the farmhouse was built in 1844, the main front part, but the dining room portion was the original cabin that stood on the property from when Ezra Maynard's family owned it in the 1820s. And so it's our belief that that is the oldest building still standing in Ann Arbor, the dining room portion of Cobblestone Farm, and it was built in about 1828. So check it out when you're there. It's a very interesting small structure, and those types of houses don't really exist anymore. They were torn down over 100 years ago in most cases because they were just small rustic houses that nobody cared about. And so we're very lucky to have that as a museum, as a survivor that's made it all this time since 1828. Do you have anything to add, Susan?
I was just going to say that when that was built, it was not in the city of Ann Arbor. It was way out in the country in Pittsfield Township.
So one of the things that I really, really felt strongly about is that we needed to cover a broader geographical area of Ann Arbor. The downtown is very familiar to a lot of people, but we wanted to find those hidden gems that nobody even knows about, you know, unless you live in that neighborhood. And so, as Susan was saying, when we were driving around, we covered a lot of ground. We went down a lot of streets. So, you know, one area is up Pomona. You don't think there's much historic up there in the kind of the Sunset area, Water Hill, I guess Upper Water Hill, I guess you would call that, Miller Road. So we wanted to tell the stories of these neighborhoods. And the beginning of each chapter has a map and a history of the neighborhood, when it began, the earliest houses, the different subdivisions that went into the neighborhood, and what's going on in the neighborhood architecturally. We really wanted to cover the whole spectrum from basically 1824, when white people came to Ann Arbor, all the way to the present, and talk about what's going on architecturally in these neighborhoods. And so Water Hill was a great example. Ann Arbor Hills is another great example, which anybody that's driven through there knows it's a maze, and you would never find all the houses, or if you did, you wouldn't find your way out. So we wanted to cover all these different neighborhoods, all the different corners of town, and give really, really a broad spectrum of what's going on architecturally in the city. For instance, so on Miller Road, these two houses may look familiar. We believe they were built by the Schultz family in the 1840s. I actually found out after the book was published that I was talking to the owner of the one on the left there. These two, I think, were actually twins when they were built, and the one on the left was expanded at some point in the 1840s. The house on the right is a great example of the mid-century modern style, and it's on mixed wood. It's Edward Olenke House. And so Edward Olenke and his friend Joseph Albano designed a number of buildings in town together. They were both professors at the U of M. And Joseph Albano's house is around the corner on Pomona, and they're very, very similar in design. Really, really, and they stand out in stark contrast to the more generic 50s ranches that surround it. So we want people to go to these neighborhoods and check out what's there, because there's a lot of interesting things to see. We only covered a very, very small percentage of what's over there. There's a lot of great architecture in that neighborhood that I don't think a lot of people know about, but should. And so we tried to cover a broader spectrum of the architectural styles too. We have shingle style, and all these different styles in town are spelled out in the book. Renaissance Revival, which includes the Beaux Arts and Italian Renaissance styles. Federal style, that was not covered at all in the last book, but we have a few examples of early buildings that were built in the Federal style. This is the Exchange Block on Broadway, which is Ann Arbor's oldest commercial building, built in 1832. And it has these kind of interesting Federal style kind of blind arches here, and the brick parapets, which are very reminiscent of East Coast buildings from the early 19th century. One of my biggest interests is folk houses. I love houses that were built by average people of modest means with not really a lot of architectural training, but they created something very beautiful in the process. So on the left here, we have an example of an eye house. This house is the David A. McCollum House from the 1830s. On the right here, we have the Keating House on Ann Street, which is a great example of the upright and wing style house. And then this is a very popular style in the Old West Side, which is called just gable front folk house or homestead style. We have Matt Grokoff's house, which is the oldest net zero house in America. It actually produces more energy than it uses, which is kind of an interesting rehab and reuse of a historic building. And then we have the great houses over here covered in the book on Mulholland and Murray Street. And one of the interesting things about those houses is in the true folk house tradition, they're not built with a plan. So while they all look the same as you're driving down the street, they're actually of different dimensions, different roof pitches, different dormers, somewhat similar floor plans, but they were all kind of built by carpenter memory and not really built from a single plan. So it's very interesting. Colonial Revival, great examples of that all throughout Burns Park. We have the Winkler House here from Cambridge. And then on the right, the more modest house of Eli Gallup, who was the park superintendent, who Gallup Park is named after, and was pretty much responsible for creating Ann Arbor's fantastic park system. Tudor Revival style, really prominent in the campus district around Burns Park. We have the Sigma Nu House on Oxford. And what's the name of that one, Susan? The
Observatory Lodge. Observatory Lodge, which was built as an apartment building for pretty much for people who worked at the hospital. And U of M owns it, and it's now they did a great restoration. They had replaced the windows, and they put in better windows that were more like the originals. And it is now a kinesiology department, which I think is also going to move. So they move around a lot. But it even has, as some of you, it's right to the right of it is Forest Hill Cemetery. So you can get a good expanse to look at, and it has a wonderful weather vane with a squirrel on the top that was preserved, as was the original sign. They replicated the original billboard kind of sign, hanging sign. Anyway, it's very nice.
Yeah, collegiate Gothic. This is another style we wanted to cover. Very common in a university town. You're not going to see many collegiate Gothic buildings in Dexter, but you'll see a lot of them in Ann Arbor, especially for schools and churches and university buildings. Art Moderne, again, we really wanted to focus on modern architecture and kind of raise awareness about the importance of it. Here we have the S.W. Trick Building from the 1930s. That was a Kresge's drugstore. This actually came from a Kresge's plan. And then we have the Burt Green House on the right, which was one of the earliest commissions of architect George Brigham, who's kind of the founder of modern architecture in Ann Arbor and actually taught a lot of the architects that came along in the 40s and 50s. At the U of M. So this is a great example of an Art Moderne house, which, again, you're not going to see any of those in Dexter, but you were lucky to have quite a few in Ann Arbor, and you don't really see them many other places. In mid-century modern, we love mid-century modern, and I think the awareness is growing that other people are picking up on it too, and they really love it. We have the Robert Metcalf House, who designed a number of houses in town, a number of great examples of the mid-century modern style. And then the Cabza House on the right, it was designed by architect Robert Pond in 1961. And Pond studied under Frank Lloyd Wright, and you can really see it in the design. It's really very reminiscent of Wright's Usonian houses.
I just wanted to say it's probably funny to people in the audience that Patrick and I both live in mid-19th century houses, but we love mid-20th century houses too, because we love good design and we love all kinds of architecture. Wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Two more mid-century modern houses that we chose for the book. There's about, I think, 20 or 30, something like that. But two more that we chose are the David Dennison House. And again, trying to pick from all the great houses in Ann Arbor Hills was a challenge. But one thing we tried to do was, if there was famous residents, David Dennison, Dennison Hall is named after him, world famous physicist. His house was designed by Robert Metcalf. And this house on the right, the Holcomb House, was designed by Herb Yohe. And it's interesting because, you know, everything at IKEA is trying to look like that today. And Yohe was very, very influenced by Scandinavian architecture, which you can kind of see in the style. Oh, yeah.
We got a lot of help from Nancy Duramedy and other people who have set up a group called A2 Modern. And it's an advocacy group that holds lectures and has tours. In fact, the group just had a tour of the Yohe House a couple of weeks ago, and the owner graciously let us inside. And before that, we had a tour of Lafayette Park in Detroit. So this is a really great group to support, and they gave us a list of, 20 of their favorite buildings. And some of them we scratched our heads about, but most of them wound up in the book.
Not everyone agrees on everything, as you know. Another thing we wanted to focus on, utilitarian buildings. The Washtenaw Light and Power Building from the early 1900s. The Island Park Shelter, which was literally built as a bathroom. But it's a great piece of architecture, kind of reminiscent of a folly out of Jane Austen's England. So we thought that was a great example of, you know, taking something that's basically a toilet and making it into something that's beautiful. And other great examples are the Edison buildings that they built in the early 20th century. So we have the Edison Powerhouse here that's on Broadway, I think built in 1916. And then we have the Barton Dam Powerhouse. Both, I believe, were designed by Emil Lorch, who is an architecture professor at U of M. We really wanted to pick out as many unusual buildings as we can, because there are so many wood frame buildings in town. It's hard to determine which one is more important than the other. But so on the left here, we have a Lustron House. There are 8 still standing in Ann Arbor. This one is on South 7th. Lustron houses are all metal outside, inside, all the framing, the walls, everything is metal. And it was not a popular idea. It only lasted for a couple of years, right after World War II, from 1948 to 50. But they're still around and still standing and still looking good. So this one is on 7th. This one is on the right, is on East Huron River Drive. It's a unistrut house, and it's built basically out of all metal construction on the interior. This is a style of construction that was developed by C. Theodore Larson and Walter Sanders at the U of M, and it's still used in commercial architecture today. Never quite caught on as a residential building technique, but the house was basically made to be taken apart, walls could be moved. People still stuck with their wood framing up to this very day. But it's a very, very unique example. There's only one in the city of Ann Arbor, and I believe one in Barton Hills. What's that? Oh, Dale Newman's house in Barton Hills. Another one that's interesting, another style, is adobe brick. You would not think adobe brick would last in Michigan's damp climate. You think of it more as like a Santa Fe type thing. But there are multiple adobe brick houses in Ann Arbor. And this one on State Street was built in 1844 by Newton A. Pruden. And this is kind of an interesting example because it's adobe brick, but there's also, we think there's tabby in it. Like some of the walls are tabby, which is kind of like an early form of poured cement. And then this one is on Lawrence, I believe, and it was built in 1848, and it's now a co-op. These were really fun to look into. So the Menifee House on Rose Street and the Roswell Franklin House on Longshore are made out of what's called rammed earth. And basically they took clay from the basement, used pneumatic tampers, and tamped it down so it was so strong that it was the strength of concrete, supposedly. And these two houses are both, basically adobe, compressed adobe, rammed earth. Franklin's kind of an interesting guy. He developed gliders in the 1930s, and one of his gliders is in the Smithsonian. They used to test them over Argo Pond right outside his door there. So,
were they both professors?
Yeah, they were both in the engineering department. Menifee and Franklin were both in the engineering department at U of M. And it's interesting, too, the one on the right, the windows are made of special automotive glass from the 1920s. So. Poured concrete is another building technique that was not commonly used. So this one on the right is from the 1930s, often called the castle. It was made to be indestructible and completely immune to the elements. I'm not sure if that's true. It has terrazzo floors on the inside, steel reinforced concrete on the outside, and then it was shaped to look like blocks of stone, like a little castle. And this is what's the name of this church? It's the Burkert's Church. Anyway, it was designed by Gunnar Burkert's in 1961. And it's a great example of the brutalist style. Now, people hate brutalism. And I can sort of understand why. It's a little bit cold. It's a little bit imposing. But it really makes a bold statement. Another great example in town is the Power Center, which is also featured in our book. People disparagingly call this the Holy Toaster. We also tried to find houses that, while you may not look at them and think they're anything special, like this student rental on State Street, but during the 1930s, I guess it would be, right? It was the home of Arthur Miller. He lived there with the Dahl family. Louis Dahl was a prominent historian in town, and Arthur Miller remembered, had a lot of fond memories of living with the Dahl family in this house on State Street. Again, not very, you know, it's a very unassuming house, but has a very interesting story to it. And it's one of the few remaining that Arthur Miller lived in, since they're going to be tearing down the other one. This is a kind of an interesting corner here on the corner of Kellogg and Pontiac Trail. So here we have the David A. McCollum House. It was built in 1838, but Henry Ford moved it to Greenfield Village. The reason Henry Ford moved it is because Robert Frost lived there in 1925 and 1926. It's a great example of the hen and chick style, a Greek revival, but I think the connection to Frost is the reason that Henry Ford decided it was so important. So he had it dismantled. It still stands at Greenfield Village today. So in 1938, Jean-Paul Slusser, a history professor and artist, had George Brigham design a house built on the exact same footprint and original foundations of the McCollum House where Frost lived. Slusser was apparently friends with Robert Frost and actually lived across the street during the 1920s when Frost was living on Pontiac Trail. And so this is a really great example and really early example of kind of the mid-century modern style. And again, Brigham was the father of it here in Ann Arbor. And in 1940 and 41, W.H. Auden, the famous writer, lived there. So again, a very very prominent literary corner there at Pontiac Trail and Kellogg. This house on West Madison, or is it East Madison, I believe, East Madison, is the last remaining residence of Raoul Wallenberg here in Ann Arbor. And I don't know if you guys know who Raoul Wallenberg was. He saved up to 100 million or 100,000 Jews during the Second World War. He was a Swedish diplomat who came here in the 1930s to study architecture at U of M. Later went on to do business in Hungary. And when the war broke out there, he used his position working for the Swedish embassy to save Jews all over Hungary. And it to great risk to his own personal safety. So he was bribing German officials and following the trains and the death marches, passing out protective passes to the Jews. And he's become an honorary citizen of the United States and Israel and a number of other countries for his great humanitarian efforts. So this is this very unassuming house on East Madison was the last remaining residence that he lived in during his time at University of Michigan. This is another house on Cambridge. Maybe Susan can talk about this because she knows these people.
Yeah, in the 1960s, it was the home of Joe and Ann Ware. Joe Ware was a member of the architecture faculty, and Ann Ware was friends with a lot of artists, and people like Andy Warhol would come to Ann Arbor and stay at this house. And many of their friends were members of the Once group, which was an avant-garde music group. Many of them moved to California. But in the 60s, this was quite the place to hang out. Oh, and the Ann Arbor Film Festival people were also connected to the Wares. I won't go into it. It's famous in Ann Arbor incestuous relationships.
And I'll just point out, because this is something that's near and dear to me and the music I grew up listening to, Ann Ware was friends with a kid named James Osterberg, who used to crash here a lot when he was on the run from the cops. And James Osterberg became famous as Iggy Pop, the singer of the Ann Arbor band The Stooges, who's kind of like the first punk rock band. And so growing up, I thought that was really cool. These houses also have a bit of a interesting radical history. The Rainbow People's Party and White Panther Party were residing in these houses during the late 1960s. Another famous band lived here, the MC5. And apparently the MC5 were doing target practice with the Black Panthers in the backyard. So I don't know how that went over, but it was a wild time back in the 60s. And today these are they're both co-ops. We tried to cover a broad spectrum of famous architects in the book, and some not so famous architects. So hopefully people will, they were famous in their times, but maybe a little more forgotten now. So the Frank Lloyd Wright House on Orchard Hills Drive is one that probably most people know about. That was in the original family until quite recently, and it's very well preserved. William LeBaron Jenney built this building in, I believe, 1878. And Jenny was a professor at U of M and basically went to Chicago and is considered the father of the modern skyscraper. Do you have anything else to add? I'm going to pass the mic to Susan. She is a big fan of the architects.
Well, I knew a little bit about Jenny because I'm a native of Chicago, and we always had to take a class in eighth grade on Chicago architecture. So that's when I fell in love with architecture was from that experience. But Jenny, he wasn't a professor here. I believe he was just an instructor. And he was part of the engineering department, and then they decided to eliminate it. And we didn't get a school of architecture after he left until the 1920s, when Emil Lorch founded the School of Architecture out of its engineering base. But I believe that Jenny actually influenced a lot of people who studied with him. These lesser known architects, like these Detroit firms, both Speer and Rhodes and Donaldson and Meyer, are probably people who knew about him or studied with him. I'm just guessing, but I have to do more research on this. But anyway, that building is called the Diekschant. And it was built as the Diekschant, and it's still the Diekschant, and it's hard to photograph, among other things. But they appreciate having this building and having it by someone who invented the skyscraper. Oh, and Gerald Ford was a Diek.
The Earl V. Moore School of Music on North Campus is built in 1963. The only building designed by Eero Saarinen in Ann Arbor. So he did the plan for North Campus when it was first being laid out, and this was the only he died shortly before this was even completed. So he died in Ann Arbor, I think, in 1961. Saarinen is considered one of the most important modern architects. Donaldson and Meyer, maybe Susan can elaborate. No? No? Okay. We won't elaborate.
I looked them up today. They are a firm that started in the early 1880s and went all the way through the 1930s. And they, from these two photos, you can tell that they did work in a lot of different styles. So the building on the left is from 1910. The building on the right is from 1882. One is Richardsonian Romanesque, the other is Beaux-Arts. And the last building they're known for is the David Stott Building in Detroit, which is in the Art Deco style, and is a fantastic building in downtown Detroit.
Alden Dow, famous Michigan architect, as we mentioned before. The house on the left is the Harry and Margaret Towsley House. This was Dow's first residential commission from 1932, and is considered to be the first modern building in Ann Arbor. And it's also interesting to note that it's thought to be the first house in America with an attached garage facing the street. So that led to a lot of horrible architecture from the 60s. Oh yeah, and Margaret Towsley was Alden Dow's sister. Alden Dow built the City Hall, which is much maligned, but still a very important building in our opinion. Part of the reason it's so maligned is that it's been hacked up and they didn't complete it in the way that he designed, the budget cuts and all that, and then they put that horrible court building on the front. Albert Kahn. Albert Kahn's probably one of the most important architects of the 20th century, or one of the more important architects of the 20th century. The work he did with steel-reinforced concrete in Henry Ford's factories was revolutionary, and Susan was telling me he designed factories in Russia, all over the world, lots of factories in Detroit, a lot of residential buildings. His residential buildings are actually a little more conservative in the traditional tastes of the day. Very nicely designed, though, generally. But he's mostly known for his industrial buildings, which were very groundbreaking. Huge expanses, open factory floors, large banks of windows that made them light and airy, as opposed to the old 19th century factories, which were dark and dingy. So quite groundbreaking. Ann Arbor Brothers Pond and Pond designed a number of buildings in town here. This is one of their early residential commissions. They later went on to design buildings in Chicago and came back and designed a number of buildings at the U of M, too. Spears and Roan. These are two of U of M's. There's only about four 19th century buildings left on U of M's campus. They were all torn down. And Newberry Hall here on the left and Tappan Hall on the right were both designed by Spear and Roan's. Again, Alden Dow, a number of buildings on U of M's campus. We really like this, the Fleming Administration Building. The rumor was that it was built to be riot-proof, which is totally untrue, because it was actually designed before all the riots in the late 60s. But one of the interesting things to note about it is its resemblance to a Piet Mondrian painting. And Dow was a big fan of Mondrian, and you can see it in the design. I'm not sure that this was a popular building for those that have worked in it. You can see the interesting placement of windows might lead to an interesting placement of windows on the interior, but it's still an very interesting building. And more Albert Kahn. Albert Kahn designed tons of buildings on campus. Just a few, Angel Hall, Burton Memorial Tower, Hill Auditorium, the Clements Library, the Natural Science Building. Am I missing any? Graduate Library, Hatcher Graduate Library. And the Ruth Finn Museums Building, which may be biting the dust soon. Hopefully not. So Kahn's influence is very, very strong in the central campus. During the early 1900s, he designed many, many buildings through about, I think the Burton Tower is 1940, something like that. So pretty much all the really important early campus buildings, or at least most of them, were designed by Kahn. And then Pond and 036 on Burton Tower. And then here's Pond and Pond. What they're most known for in town here are these really great kind of semi-collegiate Gothic arts and crafts, and then a little bit of deco on the student publications building here. Really great buildings like the Union, the Student Publications, and the Michigan League were all designed by Pond and Pond.
One tidbit about the Union is that apparently the Union is built on the site of the house where the Pond brothers grew up, and one of the Pond brothers stood in front of it and pointed out and said, "That's where my bedroom was." So they were not sentimentalists at all.
Apparently not. It was quite a beautiful house. This building has grown on me. I didn't know anything about the Power Center. I always hated it when I was a student here at U of M. But it was designed by Kevin Roche and John Dinkeloo, who are very, very prominent architects of the modernist style. This is in the Brutalist, I guess it's mostly Brutalist. It's got a giant concrete wall on the Huron-facing side, but really great reflective glass and apparently a really great experience. I've never actually been to anything at the Power Center, but it's apparently a really great viewing experience. And then Smith, Hinchman and Grills. And I think this is Susan's favorite building, one of your favorite buildings. It's close. Rackham Graduate School of Graduate Studies. And then some of the early buildings on campus that are still standing are the President's House, which is one of the original university buildings built in 1840. And then the Detroit Observatory, which is open for tours. It's been restored. A really, really beautiful Greek Revival Italianate building that still has its original glass lens from when it was built in the 1850s. And the Law Quad, such an iconic building and a really great part of what the U of M experience is all about, just walking through there on a beautiful summer day or a fall day. And there's all the little gargoyles and really great detail, leaded glass windows, which a lot of it has been recently restored. And this was a controversial choice that we still get grief from certain members, which I will not name. They're sitting in the back. The U of M Stadium, it was built in 1928, since enlarged, expanded. It had to go in the book. It's probably the most famous building in Ann Arbor, at least from a national perspective. It's one of the largest stadiums in the country, and you know, every Saturday during football season, it's very much a part of the national spotlight, so we had to include that. And then the Yost Fieldhouse, too, another iconic building from the athletic campus, which has actually been nicely repurposed and reused and preserved. Who designed Yost? Yes, Smith, Hinchman and Grills, that is correct. 1922 to 23 it was built. And so I think, and maybe Susan can elaborate on this a little bit, but U of M and Ann Arbor are so interconnected, and it's kind of, as a townie, I kind of get sick of them. I get sick of the students. I get sick of them bulldozing parts of neighborhoods to build, you know, giant dorms. But the story of Ann Arbor's architecture is really incomplete and completely, you know, lacking without a study of U of M's buildings. And so we really wanted to bring the two together. Since U of M won't even write a book on its own buildings, somebody had to do it. So we did that in this book, and we really wanted to just show that it is a big part of our experience here in Ann Arbor. So you have in the neighborhoods all these fantastic modern houses. Who lived in them? U of M professors who were forward-looking and had different ideas about, you know, how we should live. They hired their friends in the architecture school to design them for them. It's just a big part of our experience here in town, and we thought it was important to mention that in the book here.
Yeah, and these are two buildings that indicate where town and gown meet each other, and we are hoping that this book will be a bridge between the town and the gown. And thank you very much.